because Larry seemed to be waiting for him to respond in some way. The goblin nodded.
Buonarotta has not named an heir for a very long time.
The ones he picked kept getting ambitions, murmured Marsilia. He got tired of killing his favorites. What he has now is a collection of lieutenants, powerful in their own ways, but not the second. He has no Deru.
Larry said, So what happens to the collective when Buonarotta dies is this. Every master vampire in Europe, and a fair number of them back home, think that they should step into Buonarotta's place. Most of them because of ambition. Because vampires, present company accepted, I'm sure, are ambitions. But there will be some of them who are interested because they don't want to be bowing and scraping to a vampire who might be stupider or more horrid than Buonarotta.
You have a point, Adam said.
So how do you think that they will make their first bid to step under Buonarotta's empty crown, eh?
Kill the dumb werewolf who assassinated the king, Adam said slowly.
And failing that, or even if someone gets you, Adam, someone else will go after your people and your family too in an effort to build a name for themselves. Killing Buonarotta won't keep Mercy safe. If you kill him, his successors will go after you, after Mercy, after your daughter Jessie, your whole pack, Marsilia's Seethe, and any supernatural or human who has been associated with you. The best way to keep your people safe is to make Buonarotta believe that it is in his best interests that your wife and daughter, as well as everyone in this room, and their loved ones, stay alive. And that rang true enough that the beast inside of Adam considered it.
Talking with Buonarotta is best, said Honey. But if you want to kill him, I'll help.
And I, said Elisaveta, would enjoy it, Adia. And with all the reasons for leaving the vampire walking that he'd been presented with, it was the voices of murderous support that allowed him to take his first deep breath since he'd gotten off the plane.
Thank you, he told them with real gratitude. But Larry is right. Without the Maroc to shield us with his reputation, our people would be targets. As good as it would feel to kill Buonarotta, he didn't want to loose a horde of vampires on his people. Larry had also been right that Adam had gotten used to dealing from the position of strength provided by the Maroc support. It had been so much a part of being a werewolf alpha that he hadn't even thought about it. He was going to have to fix his thinking. Everyone was still watching him intently, so he waved them off and changed the subject back to an earlier one, saying, Elisaveta gets a bedroom. Marsilia gets a bedroom. Stefan, you and Larry can fight over the third bedroom. Loser gets the couch out here. Honey and I can sleep in wolf form out here, too.
Adam, if you want to continue our ruse, you should put your luggage in my bedroom, suggested Marsilia. Larry, you should take the third bedroom. Stefan and I can share a bed.
I will have the gold room, said Elisaveta coolly, before he could answer the vampire. Marsilia, the rose room is the biggest. If you share it with Stefan, then your purported threesome will have the largest room. The blue room should be adequate for the Goblin King.
We don't call ourselves that, said Larry dryly. That was just that one movie. I mean, Larry the Goblin King just doesn't have the right ring to it. The blue will do fine, I'm sure.
The gold room was, Adam noticed, the only bedroom that didn't share a wall with the interior of the house.
If Buonarotta sent someone through the wall after them, they would either break into the main room, the rose room, or the blue room.
Perhaps Elisaveta hadn't noticed that, but he wouldn't bet on it. The witch was very good at looking out for herself. Instead of a dining room, they were taken to a large room that had once been a library. Adam could still smell the old glue and leather that had been used to manufacture books, as well as the complex, musty smell libraries accumulated over time because paper absorbed odors. Their entrance was more dramatic than he'd have willingly participated in, but he hadn't noticed until much too late to do anything about it. Truthfully, he wasn't entirely certain how or when the theatrical element had been instituted, though he had a very good guess about who was responsible. As they'd exited their suite en masse, Marsilia had taken his arm, evidently deciding that, since he hadn't spoken,
Adam would be willing to continue the farce that he and Marsilia were lovers. Only then did he realize that their entire party, including Elisaveta, had somehow managed to be color-coordinated. Adam's gray suit was Mercy's favorite of the suits she had picked out for him, claiming that his choices of business wear were deliberate attempts to downplay his looks. He'd worn it this evening for Mercy, with the black shirt and his brown and silver tie. She wouldn't know, of course, but he did. He would have sworn that no one except he himself had known which suits he'd packed, of which one he was going to wear until he had it on. Even so, Marsilia's semi-formal dress was silver with brown trim. Stefan's suit was a pale brown, and he wore it with a gray shirt and a silver and black tie. Larry's suit was black and silver, with a silvery waistcoat, and his shirt and tie were brown. Honey wore a dark brown dress trimmed in black that wasn't as formal as Marsilia's, even though it covered less. Contrary to type, Elisaveta had chosen to dress all in black. She usually dressed like a fantasy novel version of a Russian grandmother who'd been raised by the Roma, complete with multiple skirts, scarves, and jewelry in bright colors. Mercy had told him once that she thought that Elisaveta had once been a beautiful woman, not just attractive, but world-class beautiful. Tonight, he understood exactly what she meant. Adam wasn't interested in fashion as an art form, but he understood how he could use it as a weapon in the business world against men and women who used wealth to judge power. That meant he knew men's fashions, but also that he didn't pay any attention to women's clothing except to note whether it looked good on Mercy or not, which put him one up on Mercy, who didn't pay attention to fashion at all. Not that women didn't use clothing like a weapon in the business world, too, but because he never judged people by the richness of their clothing, he was free to ignore the fashionable weapons of the opposite sex. But that indifference left him without words to label the outfit Elisaveta wore. It was silk. He knew fabric, and silk had a recognizable smell and a sound as it slid over itself. It was black, and it was form-fitting, and Elisaveta wore it with style, whatever it was, because it didn't fit neatly into the categories he knew. Dress, pants, suit. It began with a long tailored shirt that hung down to her knees while it sprouted embroidery that was black but also iridescent. Beneath the shirt, her skirt was narrow and slitted up to mid-thigh on each side to allow for movement. She went barefoot for reasons of her own, probably related to magic. Her feet were lovely, with manicured and polished in sparkling silver nails. She was old, nearly, he thought, as old as he was, and unlike werewolves, witches aged just like regular humans. But she had muscle and not an extra ounce of anything else on her frame. He'd always known she was strong because he watched the way people moved. He hadn't known that her body was beautiful. She'd toned down the makeup from pancake to ballroom, and it suited her. She did not dress to minimize her age. She didn't dress to minimize anything. She didn't need to. She looked exactly like what she was. Beautiful and deadly. The only two of his people left out of the fashion show were his pilot and co-pilot, who trailed behind the rest of them. They were still wearing the semi-uniform business garb they'd flown in. Black slacks, white dress shirt, and green tie. Though for all Adam knew, it was a second set of identical clothing. Still, they didn't match everyone else, so that was something. Their guide to dinner, a female vampire clad in a tuxedo, had been under the impression that the help would be dining in the kitchen with the rest of the human staff. Adam had put the kibosh on that. Harris had put his neck out a lot farther than Adam or he had planned when the vampires insisted that they leave the plane. Adam wasn't about to let Harris or his co-pilot run around loose in Buonarroti's seethe without protection. They would eat with his party in reasonable safety. They had waited while the vampire had texted someone. As soon as the return text came, she'd agreed to the additions to dinner, a phrase that made Larry grin and mock snap his teeth behind the vampire's back. The arrangements for dinner had distracted Adam, so he hadn't noticed the black, silver, and brown theme until they were following their guide through the halls. Far too late to run back and change into his blue suit. Adam wasn't entirely certain that the color coordination wasn't an accident. But instincts, and a hint of guilt in Honey's face, told him that this whole performance had been planned behind his back, up to and including the way that Marsilia clung to his arm. All this drama was in keeping with the vampires and with Marsilia anyway. Adam was an old soldier who, like good boots, could be polished up and given a shine. But in the end, he was happier being a weapon than an art piece. This was the second time Marsilia had changed their approach without checking with him. If that was how she wanted to play this, he'd feel free to do the same. In any case, the entrance was wasted because the room was empty. With a murmured encouragement for them to await Buonarrota here, their guide executed a quick bow and left. Adam surveyed his people rather grimly. Stefan broke first, probably because he was enjoying himself.
"I told you the color thing was a bad idea," he told Marsilia.
"Not here," Adam said, though their guide was gone. His ire was appeased, not by Stefan's apology. With Buonarrota apparently claiming the right of making a grand entrance, the whole drama had been mostly a wasted effort. Punishment enough to suit the crime, he thought. Since they were stuck here, Adam did a little recon. Sometime in the last 10 years, the room had been gutted, fitted with modern electricity, and put back together with drywall and engineered hardwoods. There were only 2 windows. The light would have damaged the books when it had been a library, he supposed. A good designer had done his best to make the room look as though it had last been decorated a couple of 100 years ago, despite the modern lighting, air vents, and energy-efficient windows. The central area was mostly empty, with chairs lining the walls and a small writing desk in the corner. Art was the true focus of the room. Oil paintings of eclectic sizes from various eras covered the walls 3 layers high. They were all originals, and mostly, to Adam's averagely educated eye, very well done. 1 or 2 were spectacular. There were no signatures, and he did not recognize any of them, which surprised him a little. He'd have thought a vampire of Buonarrota's reputation would put out famous artists to establish his status. Then Adam realized that he knew the subject of the painting he'd paused by. Marsilia, her eyes in shadow, crouched gracefully on a rock on the edge of a stream. Her hair, longer than he'd ever seen it, did nothing to cover her naked body. Clasped loosely in one hand was a dagger. Seeing that famous in certain circles painting, Adam realized that the vampire had been establishing his status all right. All of the paintings had been done by Buonarrota himself. A door opened, not the one they'd entered the room through, and Buonarrota strolled in. Adam had never met Buonarrota in the flesh, but he'd seen a few sketches, and there was one painting, perhaps also painted by Buonarrota, and Marsilia's sieve. That was enough to allow him to recognize the Lord of Night on sight, even if he probably couldn't have picked him out of a crowd. Like the rest of the men, excepting Adam's pilot and co-pilot, Buonarrota wore a suit. The biggest difference between his suit and Adam's was that Buonarrota's suit only emphasized the vampire's brutally stamped features. It wasn't that the suit looked wrong. It was that it looked like it was designed to showcase a warrior, a dangerous man. Adam's suit, which made him look very civilized, was a disguise. Adam preferred it that way. The master vampire gave Adam a half bow.
"I am Buonarrota. I have met you through the eyes of my servant, but you have not met me."
Adam introduced his people, gravely, including Marsilia and Stefan, both of whom Buonarrota greeted mutely with that quick, polite nod as if they were strangers. For their own protection, Adam stuck his pilot and co-pilot in the middle of the introductions to make it absolutely clear that Adam felt they fell into the category of his people. He did not introduce them by name, as an added protection for them. Including them in the middle also mixed up the whole color theme, which he appreciated. All the while, he and Buonarrota sized each other up.
"Your wife is no longer in my care," Buonarrota said, apparently deciding to be straightforwardly honest.
Adam waited politely. On the outside, he was sure his face was polite anyway.
"She misunderstood my intentions, I think," said the vampire, with a small smile on his face. "Otherwise, she would not have run from here. I did not get the chance to let her know you were coming."
Or maybe not so honest.
"Did she?" Adam asked.
"So she misunderstood that you hit her car with a semi, almost killed her, then compounded the incident by kidnapping her?"
"Adam,"
Marsilia said, her grip on his arm tightening to painful levels. When she spoke, there was an instant during which something passed across the Lord of Night's face. Marsilia saw it. Adam felt her fingers clench, but he couldn't see her face. "We know that Mercy isn't here," he told Bonarata. And by the vampire's careful lack of expression, Adam knew that Bonarata had fought to surprise them. He didn't want Bonarata to have an opening to ask how they knew Mercy was gone. Not while Mercy was still out on her own, so he continued briskly. "Recovering my wife is no longer our purpose here. I think we should talk about why you decided to take her in the first place."
"I had hoped to talk business after last meal," said Bonarata.
"Had you?" said Adam neutrally. Not a question, just an acknowledgement of Bonarata's plans. It was a good thing that Larry had talked sense before they'd come down to eat, because Adam's temper flared hotly, and he knew that his eyes were wolf yellow. He took a deep breath.
"It is something civilized people would do," Bonarata said mildly.
"Which neither of you is," Marsilia said archly.
Bonarata looked at her sharply, his eyes lingering on the way her hand stayed on Adam's shoulder. This time, Adam recognized the flare that broke through Bonarata's semi-civilized expression as jealousy.
"Why did you take my wife?" he asked.
The vampire's eyes met his, and Adam felt the draw of the vampire's gaze even as he cursed himself for allowing it to happen. He knew better. He prepared to fight his way out of it, drawing on his bond to Honey and to Mercy. And the vampire's gaze slid right off Adam without effect.
"Why?"
Adam let his voice soften with the rage that simmered around the image of his SUV after the semi had hit it.
"Did you take my mate?"
Silence rang loudly in the room as no one moved or spoke.
"Iacopo," murmured Marsilia, letting her hands slide off Adam's arm.
"Jacob," the vampire said coolly.
"Jacob,"
she corrected without apology.
"You did not set out to kill Adam's mate. That would be stupid and wasteful. And the man I knew for centuries is too smart for either."
"Or to respond to flattery," he said.
She threw up both hands high, then let them drop to her sides as she spoke.
"It is not flattery if it is true. You did not intend her death, so why did you take her?"
"You are in the wrong," murmured Stefan.
"Everyone in this room understands this, including you, Jacob. To pretend otherwise is unproductive."
"And heaven keep us from being unproductive," growled Bonarata.
But he turned to Adam.
"I went to Wolf for information, as you know. This was my mistake, and I apologize for it. I have known Wolf a long time. I know that he enjoys causing trouble, but I thought I had taught him better than to cause me trouble. I will see to it that it does not happen again."
Marsilia reached out and grasped Adam's arm, digging her nails in deeply. But he didn't need her request. He shook his head at Bonarata. "Wolf lives in my territory. He is under my protection. Moreover, he did not lie to you. My mate is the single most powerful person in our territory." He waved his hand to include the rest of his people in the room. "Witness the quality of the people willing to put their necks out for her, and I turned down a lot of help." He decided not to give Bonarata an excuse to react to Adam's defense of Wolf, a defense that Bonarata had been expecting, if Adam was reading the vampire aright. So he kept talking. "Why did you kidnap someone you expected to be the most powerful person in the Tri-Cities?" Bonarata veiled his eyes.
"Your territorial grab is a very interesting thing, Mr. Hauptmann. A place where we could deal with the humans and each other in safety is very valuable. But to say that is what you have, and to actually be able to keep people safe is another thing entirely."
"I agree," said Adam.
Bonarata turned and walked to a dry bar and poured himself a drink of something that smelled like port to Adam.
"Would you like some? It doesn't affect me, of course, any more than it would affect you, but I like the taste."
Adam let his eyes become half-lidded, and Marsilia petted his arm soothingly. Adam watched Bonarata notice her hand, watched the vampire throw the alcohol back. It wasn't true that it didn't affect either of them. Alcohol would give a werewolf a momentary jolt, then the effects dissipated. Sherwood Post, one of the last werewolves Bran had sent to join Adam's pack, said he discovered that even a werewolf could get drunk by drinking Everclear, the 190-proof version, fast enough. He'd stayed that way by drinking steadily for 2 days before Bran took away his alcohol and told him to grow up. "No," Adam said. "I never acquired the taste before I changed, and I see no reason to start now. You are going to tell me why you took my wife."
Onorata set his empty glass down.
"Yes. Where did I leave off?"
"You had decided to see if we could protect our own," said Marsilia softly. "You asked Wolf who the most powerful among us was, and he told you. For reasons that make sense only to Wolf. For all that he explained them to us, he told you that person was Adam's mate, Mercedes. So you broadsided her car with a semi-truck and hurt her mortally, and then kidnapped her."
"She is alive," Adam said. And despite his best effort, his voice emerged as more of a growl than a human voice.
"Despite your best efforts."
"Oh, yes," Bonarata said. "The famous mating bond of song and story."
He smiled tightly at Adam.
"She was dying," he said, "because Wolf misled me. If you wish for him not to have consequences for that, I suppose I am not the one to suffer the most from his games. My people called me to report the issue, and I almost left her there. Her death would have told me what I wanted to know, after all, that you cannot protect your own."
Adam didn't say anything, just watched Bonarata with patience. His wolf was pretty convinced that Bonarata was not going to survive long, no matter what the overarching consequences might be. Bonarata kept setting himself in front of them and making himself a target. Eventually, Adam's control would fail, and the wolf would feast. Bonarata tried to outstare Adam. Marsilia let out a huff of air and walked between them, breaking their stare down with her body. For the first time, Adam realized that the heels she wore made her taller than either of them.
"But you didn't leave her to die," she told Bonarata.
"No," he said, his face and body language softening as he spoke to Marsilia. "Because ultimately, my aim wasn't to destroy what you had built, but to use it. Her death was not my intent. So I had my team fly her to Portland, where I have a witch on retainer. She kept Mercedes alive until she could be brought here, and my own healer could bring her out of danger."
Adam was pretty sure that the pause that Bonarata followed his speech with was intended as an opportunity for Adam to say thank you, which he wasn't going to do.
"I have a witch on retainer also," Adam murmured instead. "A very powerful witch."
Elisaveta made a pleased sound. It would perhaps have been better for Mercy to stay in the Tri-Cities when she was so badly hurt, rather than carting her halfway around the world. A chime sounded.
"Ah," Wanarata said, "that would be dinner. I'm afraid my chef insists that we'd not dine late. I've had to increase his salary twice this year after such incidents. We will have to hold this conversation after we sit and you eat, yes?"
Adam nodded politely and let Marsilia and Stefan follow Bonarata through yet another door, while he lingered to take the rear. Elisaveta kissed his cheek as she passed, probably because of the compliment he'd thrown her way. Larry and Harris, the goblins, were deep in discussion in a language he didn't know, but it sounded vaguely Germanic. Norwegian or Norn or Old Icelandic, for all he could tell. Harris's co-pilot trailed behind them, apparently following the conversation. Honey, who had taken it upon herself to play guard for the co-pilot, fell in beside Adam.
"What is his name?" Adam asked, tilting his head toward Harris's man.
He'd been given it when he met the two pilots at the airport, but he'd been struggling with the wolf, and it had gone in one ear and out the other, something not usual for him. But if the co-pilot was going to be among the people Adam was responsible for, Adam needed a name.
"Matthew Smith," said the man himself in a meek voice, though he didn't turn back. "You can call me Matt, sir."
Then he gave Honey and Adam both a shy smile over his shoulder. I've heard all the jokes. I prefer Tom Baker anyway. Honey looked at Adam, puzzled by the reference.
Doctor Who, Adam told her.
Matt Smith played the 11th Doctor. Tom Baker was the 5th or 6th.
4th, said Harris with a grin. He's the guy with the scarf.
Doctor Who, said Honey slowly, because the whole pack knew that Adam didn't like TV much.
Mercy makes me watch it, Adam said defensively. She says it's for my own good.
Matt, the co-pilot, huffed a little laugh under his breath, and Adam caught himself smiling a little.
I'm not sure what that means, but I'm enjoying it.
Doctor Who had been unexpectedly good, but he'd have watched reality TV or even a soap opera in order to sit around for an hour with Mercy cuddled beside him. He checked his bond, and Mercy was there, too distant to communicate with, but she was there. Just as she'd been the last 100 times, he checked for her. Dinner was through a double door and into a well-lit, high-ceilinged room that could have been the main seating area of any high-class restaurant. Instead of a single long table, there were a number of tables that sat from 2 to 6 people, spread with conscientious randomness around the room. The whole room could have seated maybe 100 people, but not so many were expected tonight. Numerous tables, each seating 4, draped in pink linen tablecloths and blue and white place settings. There were deep rose-colored place cards on each plate with names scribed on them. The first one that Adam glanced at proved that Bonarata had investigated Adam's people. It read, Matthew Smith. He rounded the table, reading the other names at the table. Stefan Uccello, Larry Sethaway, and Austin Harris. Matt, here's your seat, he said, keeping his voice kind because the other wolf didn't deserve the sharpness of the sudden possessive bite of an alpha wolf who feels like someone is trying to take his pack away from him. It wasn't just that Bonarata had known Matthew Smith's name. It was that he had surrounded the vulnerable wolf with the people Adam would have put around him. Stefan for strength, Harris for familiarity, and Larry because no one would expect him to be as dangerous as he was. He'd have weighed replacing Larry with Honey, but the two goblins would be more likely to fight well together. Bonarata had done him a favor, and it drove his wolf wild because of the impertinence of it, presuming to make decisions that belonged to Adam. Protecting his people was his job. Or maybe he was overreacting because he didn't know where Mercy was. Probably he was overreacting. The co-pilot sat down in the chair Adam had indicated for him. He put a hand on Adam's knee and asked,
"Trouble?"
in a low voice that wouldn't carry, even to the ears in the room. This wolf was the only person besides Honey in the room whom Adam's wolf did not view as prey or possible threat. The touch on his knee steadied him as nothing else could have in that moment. Adam had a job to do, and that job did not include playing stupid games with an ancient vampire. He took a breath and nodded to the other wolf. "Thank you," he said. The co-pilot dropped his eyes and bowed his shoulders to look smaller than he was. And he wasn't a big man.
"Glad to be of use," he told Adam.
Feeling more in control, though he supposed he wouldn't be back to normal until he had Mercy back safe, Adam patted the wolf on the shoulder in thanks, and when Harris found his way to his seat, he left him in good hands. He checked on Elisaveta and Honey, both of whom were sitting surrounded by vampires. Elisaveta was flirting gently in Russian with a vampire who looked like he'd rather be anywhere else. Honey ignored her companions, who were not only vampires but also women. Instead, she kept watch on the table where Matthew Smith and Harris were. It would have been rude, but the other occupants of her table were busy ignoring her pointedly, too. He just bet Honey's tender feelings were hurt. He hid his inner smile. Honey was as tough-minded as any werewolf he knew. There were, by his count, 60 people in the room, not including the waitstaff. Adam's small pack was vastly outnumbered. That was probably not an accident. Some of the guests were human. A few were other. People who were magical but fit poorly into established categories. Adam was mostly intrigued by the people he didn't see. Bonarata had Lenka, the werewolf he had enslaved. But she wasn't the only non-vampire Bonarata had in his arsenal. He'd had a powerful witch at one time, though she seemed to be missing. But there were others in his hire now. The only werewolves in the room were in Adam's party, and Elisaveta was the only witch. By the time Adam made his way to his table, he aimed for Bonarata, assuming that would be where he'd be eating. The others were seated. The Lord of Night had placed himself across from Adam. Marsilia was seated on Adam's right, Bonarata's left, and a strange vampire had the seat to Adam's left.
"You like the room?" asked Bonarata pointedly. "You took your time examining it."
"I take care of my people," Adam said with a peacefulness, one from a hand on his knee and watching Honey ignore the people ignoring her, and the solid connection of his mate bond. He decided that he could also be gracious. "The room is elegant and interesting."
"You were going to explain what happened to Mercy after you brought her here," said Marsilia.
Bonarata sighed.
"Not knowing anything about her except that Wolf had told me she was powerful, not strong, I grant you, but powerful, I put her up in a safe room outside this house, where I could keep her protected from my people and keep my people safe from her. She woke up, and we had a polite discussion. I thought all was well when I was called away to deal with other issues. I left my own werewolf to guard her. At this point, I was more concerned with my people hurting her rather than the other way around."
"Concerned," thought Adam, "could be a very unspecific word."
"You left your blood bitch to guard Adam's mate?" said Marsilia, real anger in her voice.
She looked at Adam.
"He stole the wolf female from the Milan Alpha because he could. When the Alpha objected, Jacopo had him brought here and tortured him until he'd broken them both. But Jacopo..."
"Jacob," corrected Bonarata softly. "Jacob is easier for my American context."
"Jacob," continued Marsilia without a change in her voice, "doesn't feed from males. So he had the Alpha killed, but kept his mate. She was quite mad when I left here. I cannot think that a few centuries will have helped her."
All of which Marsilia knew that Adam knew, which meant that she was bringing it up to get a reaction from Bonarata. It wasn't working.
"If Mercedes had not run, the wolf would not have chased her," Bonarata said easily.
He didn't address or acknowledge Marsilia's charge except for that correction over his first name.
"She would not have disobeyed me. Mercedes was safe until she tried to run."
Adam understood what he was hearing. Mercy had not been what Bonarata was prepared to deal with, so he'd set her up to die. A very practical thing, really. If there was only one person telling the story, there could be no debate about what had happened. Food was served at just that moment. Adam held his tongue and watched as a very rare steak was set out for him while he fought the beast inside him to a standstill. As soon as all of those eating food were served, vampire waiters brought out trays with golden goblets that they placed before the vampires. The last person served was Bonarata. He held up his goblet and said,
"Eat and drink, my friends. Tonight is a glorious night, and tomorrow will be better."
Then he said something in Italian. Adam was pretty sure the vampire was just repeating his words. He sipped his drink, and Adam did too, because there was nothing wrong with drinking to tomorrow. As soon as Bonarata set his goblet down, people started to eat. Most of the place settings were silver. Adam's was gold. He glanced at Honey and saw that her tableware was gold as well. He'd assume that Smith received the same courtesy. Adam cut into his steak and took a bite and chewed with what he hoped looked like thoughtfulness instead of restrained rage. If Mercy had not managed to escape, she'd have been dead when they arrived. "So," he said softly, "where is your pet werewolf whose job it was to keep Mercy here, I think you said?" There was a pause. Then the beautiful male vampire to his left said, a hint of amusement in his voice,
"She was hit by a bus and is currently recovering."
And just that easily, Adam's equanimity was restored. Adam nodded. "People who stand in the way of my mate's ability to get herself out of trouble often feel like they were hit by buses. I think this might be the first time it is literally true, though." He looked at the second vampire.
We weren't introduced.
This is Guccio, Buonarroti said. He is responsible for the night-to-night running of the seed. My apologies for not introducing him earlier.
Don Hauptmann, said the pretty vampire, I have heard many things about you.
Adam opened his mouth to tell him that his name wasn't Don, when Buonarroti spoke.
Signore Hauptmann is a young wolf, not even a century old.
He looked at Adam.
Don is an old term of respect. Guccio meant it so.
The explanation, though necessary, had been given with a hint of patronization.
A bus, murmured Marsilia. At least she never hit one of mine with a bus. I wonder if it was a mark of respect, or the opposite. It doesn't do to underestimate Mercedes, Jacob, something that I had to learn too. Did she give you this spiel she likes to bring out now and again about how she's mostly no more powerful than the average human? It is a most effective speech, because I think she actually believes it.
Buonarroti frowned at Marsilia.
She is weak, he said. She is easily broken, easily killed.
He frowned at Adam.
You cannot afford a weak mate if you seek out power. A plaything can be weak, because such a one is disposable. But a mate must be an asset.
Mercy weak, Adam thought.
And yet, he said coolly, Mercy is not here. And the werewolf you sent after her is still recovering.
I have news for you, Jacob.
Marsilia placed a little more emphasis than necessary on the vampire's name.
There have been a lot of people, monsters and other things, who have tried to kill Mercedes Thompson Hauptmann, and most of them died in the attempt. She is not helpless, nor is she weak.
I didn't try to kill her, said Buonarroti.
Adam stared at the vampire, hearing the lie clearly. Did the vampire not know he could hear the lie? Adam couldn't trust himself to speak.
I never said you did, Marsilia said diplomatically. Nor have I. But I have seen her at work. Your wolf is lucky it was only a bus.
Do you know where she is? Asked Adam. I trust you have been looking. On the plane, Marsilia had told Adam that Buonarroti would not rest until he found Mercy. She had made him look incompetent, and his ego would not allow him to let her escape without consequences. Buonarroti spread his hands, sighed, and said,
I have my people looking for her. It appears that she has left Italy entirely, probably by bus.
We tracked her to a bus stop in Austria, where she either traded buses or changed her mode of transportation.
I have some information that makes it apparent that she has made her way to either Prague or Berlin or possibly Munich.
Who did you send after her? Asked Marsilia.
You would not know them, Buonarroti told her. But they are good hunters. They will find her and bring her back.
Adam said slowly, You were given misleading information that inspired you to take my wife. I think it is only fair to give you information that will keep you from making a bigger mistake.
Yes, Buonarroti said.
Bran raised Mercy.
She was raised in his pack, said Buonarroti. Foster parents, of which one was a wolf, he smiled. You are correct. I started with too little information. I have made up for it.
Very good, Adam said. You already know that if my wife dies, I will not rest until you are no longer walking the earth. You don't fear that, though you should. But what you don't know is that Bran feels the same, and only an idiot would not fear Bran.
Bran has cut his ties to your peck, said Buonarroti.
Adam nodded. See? I thought you'd gotten the wrong information. That part is true enough. But that is politics. Family is different. Bran could not love Mercy more if she were his own daughter. He's funny about family. His own mother tried to hurt one of his children, and that tale is still told. You do know the story of Beowulf? And from the vampire's carefully blank face, He was fully aware of how Bran's descent into madness, when his witch-born mother had tried to force Bran to hurt Samuel, Bran's son, was tied to the myth of Beowulf. "Bran is very practical," Adam said. "He is a zealot whose cause is the survival of the werewolves. He will sacrifice almost anything to that cause. He believes that he would sacrifice either or both of his sons, and they believe it too. But whenever that seems to be a necessity, somehow matters work out differently. And Bran is nowhere near as protective of his sons as he is of Mercy. You need to listen to me as I tell you the absolute truth." He ate another piece of steak and resisted the need to meet the vampire's gaze, because Mercy's magic had rescued him once, and even for Mercy, that only worked some of the time. "If Mercy dies because of you, there is not a hole deep enough for you to hide from him.
If Bran behaves aggressively toward me without cause, he will force a war between the vampires and the werewolves," Bonarata said.
"He won't care," Adam said, his voice sure and certain. "Not all vampires could tell the difference between the truth and a lie when they heard it. But he was willing to bet that a vampire of Bonarata's age could.
He might care afterward. He might care that you didn't intend her death, but that will be afterward. Please don't push him into it."
8. Mercy. Running from vampires, again. Still. Go me. I didn't have a wristwatch, and since it was nighttime, there was no sun to help tell the time. It felt like we'd been riding the motorcycle less than an hour, but I had no way to be sure. We sped our way out of Prague proper and into a more rural area, where the road seemed to weave in and out of one tiny village after another. We turned off the main road onto a blue-railed modern bridge that crossed a river and into the labyrinthian streets of yet another village. We drove past a castle, because it was the Czech Republic, and apparently castles were required by all the best villages. The Tri-Cities had no castles. I'd never felt the lack before. My guardian angel werewolf slowed, and we puttered very quietly through a sleepy residential area. If we'd been in the U.S., I'd have said it was a bedroom community for Prague, but remembering that there was a castle, I was hesitant to apply New World labels to Old World places. Some of the houses looked very bohemian. Some of them were very modern. We passed a couple of apartment complexes, took a hard right just past the second one, and found ourselves in an area where, on one side of the road, houses had gardens, huge yards, and trees. On the other side of the road was open land. It was too dark to be sure, but I thought they might be growing hay, though it could just as easily have been some other grassy plant. It was dark, and I wasn't a farmer. We pulled into the driveway of a mansion-sized house that could have been a well-preserved 300 or 400 years old, or a run-down 20 years old. It was hard to tell in the darkness. My werewolf driver barely slowed down as we passed the ornate building, a swimming pool, and a stable, to park next to a much smaller house that might once have been a carriage house. Unlike the big building, where all the lights were on the outside and the interior was dark, the smaller house had no exterior lights on. There were fixtures beside both of the doors I could see, but the bulbs had been removed. The purr of the engine stopped, and my werewolf guard removed his helmet and braced his feet. I was wise to the invitation, and I hopped off and took my own helmet off, giving it to him when he held out his hands for it. I could smell and hear horses nearby, the swish of a lazy tail, and an occasional snort. Horses are prey, and they don't sleep in long stretches. In the pen nearest the house, someone was in the middle of planting a garden in a pen that had been set up for livestock. They weren't there now, of course, but the area had been expertly scythed. The cut hay was piled to the side, presumably to feed to the horses I'd sensed. Turf had been cut and was partially rolled, exposing rich, dark soil. Packets of seeds and a couple of mesh bags of bulbs sat in a cardboard box for planting. I only knew it had been scythed because the implement was leaning against a fence post. I knew it was expert because I'd scythed a very small pasture once, A punishment for the Easter Bunny incident, I think. My field had looked nothing like the neatly trimmed grass in the pen. While I'd been getting the lay of the land, my companion knocked at the door softly. It popped open after a bit. A woman clothed in a man's white shirt and nothing else said something in Czech that was both quiet and irritated. Her hair was dark and cut in an asymmetrical bob that flattered her cheekbones. My escort responded in a voice that was conciliatory without being submissive. The woman was a werewolf, too, a pack mate from their body language, near equal in status, too, if I was reading it right. She turned from him to me. "You are English?" she asked. "American," I told her. "So what are you doing here, and why are the vampires after you?" Her English was very good, smooth, as if she spoke it often. Her vowels were thick, though, and the consonants muted. I rubbed my face wearily. "I got in the way of a murky vampire plot," I told her. She threw her hands up impatiently. "Vampire plots are always murky. What kind of murky?" I said, "The Lord of Night hit me with a car and kidnapped me from Washington, the state, in the U.S., and brought me to Milan. I escaped with nothing but my skin and hitched a ride on a couple of random buses and ended up in Prague. Is that murky enough?" "You are not a werewolf," she said suspiciously. "And still, Libor helps you?" The man who'd brought me here spoke, and whatever he said made her frown. Frown harder, anyway. "Stop that," was what she said. "You are being rude, Martine. Speak English." To me, she said, "Why are we helping you?" Martine was evidently my rescuer's name. "I'm the maid of the Alpha of the Columbia Basin Pack," I said. She stared at me for a moment, then said a little incredulously, "You are Bran Cornick's foster daughter?" I nodded carefully, keeping my eyes up, because her reaction was a little off. "Expecting someone better looking?" I tried. "Smarter? Taller?" The wind came up, rustling in the grassy fields and blowing her scent to me. In addition to the werewolf, I could tell she was the person who had most recently used the helmet I'd worn here, and from the scent of rich earth and broken grass, she was the person responsible for the project of turning a horse run into a garden. "Well," she said after a silence that lingered a little too long to be comfortable, "you must be the Mercedes who goes by Mercy, then. I'm Yitzka." And she told me her last name, but the sounds in it had little to do with English, and I'm not sure I caught it all. I looked at the man, who gave a little laugh. "Yes," he agreed. "Matters were a little fraught for introductions. I'm Martine Zietz, Libor's second. Yitzka is..." "A lowly woman," she said with a little growl in her voice. "But after the Great War, Libor said that for me to be last because I would not take a mate was stupid. Clearly I was more fierce than most of the pack and more clever than any. He set me third behind Martine. It was acceptable, and I buried the ones who objected with my own hands." Martine grinned and said, "Pavel didn't die." "Or I seduced them," she agreed placidly. She wasn't exactly beautiful, though she wasn't exactly not beautiful either, but she looked soft, warm, and strong. Sexy. She looked like someone who could give comfort when you needed it, or a belt in the jaw, if that was more appropriate. "Pavel is a good man who needed to rethink a few things. There were several like Pavel." She looked at Martine. "I'm going to get dressed. Then you two may come in, and we will discuss what has happened and what is to be done." She left us abruptly and went back inside the little house. Martine started to speak, stopped, then laughed.
"I was going to give you my standard warning, how you should not underestimate our Yitzka, who has been outwitting men since the day she was born, but I imagine that you know better."
"Not being a man?" I asked.
"Being a person used to having people underestimate her," he said. "Libor feels that you bested him. We've been packmates for a very long time. He doesn't pout like a child on the outside, but when he does not get what he expects, then he pouts on the inside. Anyone who can get one over on Libor is..."
"Lucky?" I guessed. He smiled again.
"Maybe luck would work once, against Libor or against Jacopo Bonarata, but not against both, one after another. "You aren't afraid to say his name?" I asked. I was pretty sure that Marsilia was. There was an edge of defiance in her voice whenever she said his full name. "And you missed the memo. I guess he's in the process of turning from Jacopo to Jacob." Most of the immortals changed their names as time passed. I used to think it was to protect themselves from the humans discovering how old they were, but I changed my hypothesis lately. I think after a long time, some people grew tired of themselves. A new name gave them a chance to reinvent who they were, to become someone else, some other kind of person. Or sometimes, as in Jacopo Buonarroti's case, apparently, they decide to pick a name easier for their soon-to-be minions to say. "Jacob," Martine said thoughtfully. "I had not heard." He shrugged. "I am not a vampire to fear Buonarroti's power. He will not lightly take on Libor or the Voltava pack. That is not to say that someday there might not be war between us, but it won't be over something as small as my saying his name." He smiled, and it lit his eyes. "It might take something like you, or not." Yitka's door opened. "Okay," she said. "You..." And that's when the vampire dropped off the roof and on top of Yitka like a piano falling on Roger Rabbit. Vampires are hard to detect, because when they are still, they really don't make any noise at all. I don't know what they had done to disguise their smell, but I'd seen too many vampires move to mistake them for anything else. And once the one landed on Yitka, there were suddenly more of them. My whole life, I've heard people trying to compare vampires and werewolves. Vampires are faster and werewolves stronger, or werewolves are faster and vampires are stronger. I've now seen them both in combat enough to form my own opinion. The one thing that really matters is that both werewolves and vampires are stronger than I am. The only thing I have going to match them is speed, which is why I broke and ran. I didn't run to the road. There were innocent civilians in that direction. I didn't run to the woods. I didn't know the lay of the land. I didn't like being lost with vampires chasing me. And my coyote didn't blend in with the local fauna. Because I also didn't believe in letting other people fight my battles while I watched, I ran to the fenced paddock, rolled over the rail fence, and grabbed the scythe. I especially didn't run from a fight when there was such a handy weapon lying around. Properly armed, I turned to see what had happened while I'd been running. There were four vampires swarming Martine and Yitka, presumably having gone through the same basic evaluation that I'd just done. The werewolves were more of a threat than I was. Assuming they came from Buonarroti, the only thing they knew about me was that I'd run from Buonarroti and I was weaker than a werewolf. In the fields and the woodlands beyond the fields, it would take me a long time to run far enough that the vampires couldn't find me, so they'd ignored me and attacked the werewolves. Fights usually happen really fast, especially fights between supernatural creatures. I'd seen one or two that lasted longer because the combatants were just that tough, but even then, seconds counted. I stood behind the fence, waiting for what seemed like 10 minutes and was probably closer to 30 or 40 seconds. I thought I was going to have to try something else because the fight stayed too far away. But then Yitka threw one of her attackers like a shot put. She, the vampire, not Yitka, hit a post and staggered. She grabbed the fence for support, her eyes on Yitka. I hooked the scythe between the top two rails of the fence and around the vampire's neck just under her jaw. I never, ever thought that mowing that field with a scythe would be useful to me. Who uses a scythe in the era of lawnmowers and tractors? To make that exact point, Bran had parked a new, wide-swath riding lawnmower just outside the field. He wanted to rub in the fact that all the sweaty, back-breaking work I was doing could have been done in an hour on the riding lawnmower. By the time I'd finished, I'd had blisters, muscles in my arms and back in places I didn't know I had muscles, and I'd learned a lot about how a scythe worked. The first rule of cutting grass with a medieval farm implement is that the blade has to be sharp, or when it hits the grass, it will bend it over instead of cutting it. The sharp side of the blade is on the side nearest the scytheman, so he hooks the grass and pulls it with a smooth motion that uses his whole body, like a golfer. I think. I don't golf, but the motion a golfer makes when hitting the ball looks a lot like the one I developed by trial and error to cut waist-high grass. The same motion I used on the vampire. I caught her totally by surprise because her attention was on the werewolves. Evidently, Yitka knew about keeping her scythe sharp, because it slid through flesh like a hot knife through butter. It was easy, only a little hesitation as the blade hit the bone, and it was done. Expecting a more difficult task, I used too much force and overbalanced myself, put a foot on the edge where the sod had been cut, and rolled and fell on my butt in the dirt. I was too worried about cutting myself with the scythe to try to roll, but I scrambled to my feet as quickly as I could. Or almost as quickly as I could, because I found a little more speed when I realized that the head had landed right next to me. Pretty much anything that is decapitated dies and stays that way, even the kinds of things that are otherwise immortal. Vampires' bodies turn to ash when they are dead, mostly, though I've learned over the past few years that isn't always true. There are apparently some strains of vampirism that don't do that at all. Younger vampires tend to have bodies just like real people. But vampirism is magic-fueled, and magic doesn't follow the rules all the time like science does. What that means is this. If I decapitate Wolf someday, he will probably turn to ash, because he is very old. If he doesn't turn to ash, I'll burn his body and his head. Either way, I will take his ashes and scatter them in both the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, salt being a pretty effective deterrent to magic. I don't know of anything that decapitation followed by burning doesn't kill, but with Wolf, I wouldn't take any chances. I was comfortable that the vampire I'd scythed was dead. The eyes staring at me were blank and fogged. I didn't know her well enough to know if I should have been as scared of her as I was of Wolf, so I assumed not. While beheading the vampire had only taken seconds, the fight had gone on without us. I didn't think anyone had noticed what I'd done. The vampire hadn't made much noise, and the other combatants were fully engaged in their own battles. Moving fast requires a lot of focus. It takes a Charles or an Adam to pay attention to anything more than the fight in front of him. Yitka had a knife in one hand and something I couldn't see too well in the other. Maybe it was a screwdriver. The vampire she was fighting had a short sword. Yitka hadn't been exaggerating her competence. Despite the inequality in weaponry, the battle was not going in the vampire's favor. Martine had incapacitated one of his opponents. The big male vampire wasn't going anywhere with his back broken and his body spasming helplessly under the randomized signals his nervous system sent out. Short swords must have been the weapon of choice, because Martine had one that he was using to engage the short sword his second vampire opponent had. The wolf must have taken the sword from the disabled vampire, because he hadn't been carrying it with him on the motorcycle. I'd have noticed. The vampire jumped back out of the way of Martine's strike and staggered. I hopped on the top rail of the fence and brought the point of the scythe over his shoulder and into his abdomen. The blade stuck. Maybe it caught on a belt buckle. I tried to throw myself backward off the fence to use the weight of my body to force the blade deeper. Had the vampire panicked or frozen, I'd have eviscerated him. But he grabbed the shaft of the scythe and I had to let go or risk his pulling me somewhere I didn't want to go. I could not afford to let him get a shot at me. When I hit the dirt this time, I rolled to my feet and took a quick step back before I figured out that the vampire wasn't going to be coming after me or anyone again. Martine had taken advantage of the vampire's distraction and used his sword to do what I hadn't managed. He'd broken the blade doing it, but he'd cut the vampire, pretty messily, in half from belly through collarbone and out the top of the shoulder. The end of the sword had lodged in a rib and broken off. Martine brought the broken blade down on the vampire's neck and decapitated him. Yitka's final opponent went boneless and dropped to the ground, a screwdriver sticking out of one eye. Face grim, the werewolf took the sword the vampire had been using and struck off his head, as if she'd worked for years decapitating vampires on an assembly line. The stroke was that precise and emotionless. The dead vampire crumbled to ash in a flash of heat that ate the clothes he was wearing, but left the shoes untouched. About that time, the female I'd killed just sort of faded into dust, a lot less dramatic than her comrade. Yitka took the sword and looked around, her body language relaxed. She walked to the spasming vampire, looked closely at his face with a frown, then beheaded him. Without a guillotine or